The domestic impact of the Napoleonic Wars. Following the lectures on empire and colonialisation, and also on war, what I'd like to look at today is the domestic impact of the French Wars, and in particular on three areas: on the economy, society, and on politics. Contemporaries from the aristocracy or the middle classes were often positive about the economic effects of the war. So, for example, William Forbes, a banker, spoke of that wonderful extension of commerce and manufactures, which, contrary to all former example, continued to swell as the war was protracted. Amongst historians and economists, interpretations, though, have ranged widely. Nicholas Crafts, at one extreme, attributes little to wartime dislocation or stimulus. And this is because, like other economic historians, his view of the French Wars is inextricably bound up with his views of Britain's first industrial revolution. So for Crafts, British industrialisation occurred over a long period, during which appropriate institutions and technologies only emerged slowly. Thus the war had little impact, as British industrial growth occurred at such a slow pace. On the other hand, Geoffrey Williamson has a different view of British industrialisation. He takes as his starting point that modern economic growth always follows a general pattern. This is exemplified by experiences of third world economies today or the 19th century US economy. Thus, modernisation should begin with rapid growth. He argues that it was the stress of the wars, and only the stress of the wars, that deflected Britain from this pattern. Wartime government borrowing crowded out productive investment. He's been challenged by historians, partly on his basic premise that industrialisation always follows a general pattern, but also many economic historians find little evidence of crowding out of private investment, and at least not enough to bear the weight that Williamson puts on it. Patrick O'Brien, on the other hand, has eschewed a quantitative approach to this question, arguing that data constraints make it unviable, and also there's a need to consider fully the short and the long-term consequences of the wars. He agrees that growth rates of domestic output declined during the wars and that consumption standards were also 10 to 20% below the levels, pre-war levels. But could one assume that the growth rate of the 1780s would have continued indefinitely? For O'Brien, the assessment of the wars should look at the impact of the changes in government revenue raising, the changes in agriculture, and changes on the pressure for innovation. When we look at the funds that were raised by the government to pursue the war between 1793 and 1815, we can see that it's very different from the pattern of earlier wars. 60% came from taxes, not from borrowing. As a result, private consumption fell sharply, partly because of taxation and partly because of wartime inflation. And this had the result of redistributing income from the bulk of householders and wage earners to the farmers, employers and property owners. And as a consequence of this, private capital investment remained stable. Wars also had a commercialising effect on agriculture. But in O'Brien's view, this produced a cage from which it was very difficult to escape, in that the reliance on high agricultural prices and the need to exploit farm labour was an imperative. In addition, he looks at the effects on industry, arguing that although rates and scales of bankruptcies went up, these were more than compensated by the rise of new generations of entrepreneurs and also the amount of foreign trade which was developed in this period. Thus, for O'Brien, you have to balance the short-term costs of the war against long-term benefits such as the capture of foreign trade, the unification with Ireland, the opening up of Latin America, and the seizure of enemy colonies. In addition, the wars inflicted much greater costs on the economies of the rival European powers, which gave Britain an advantage. When we look further down the social scale, though, we get a different picture of the effects of the war. In particular, the low wages and high prices led to widespread industrial disorder. The most common manifestations of these were the outbreaks of Luddism, which occurred on the wide scale from 1811. These were outbreaks of machine breaking, which began in the stocking frame industry, and the distinguishing features were the letters and proclamations that were delivered bearing the signature Ned Ludd, King Ludd, or General Ludd. Luddite attacks were at their height from 1811 to 1812, after which some of the leading Luddites were sentenced to transportation for life. There have been various interpretations of Luddism. The most simplistic see it as a futile and sporadic attempt to halt the process of industrialisation. Other historians, such as E.P. Thompson, however, see Luddism as a quasi-political movement which had ulterior revolutionary objectives. John Rule, in his book The Labouring Classes, argues that Luddism was primarily a guerrilla campaign seeking to salvage the old protectionist and paternalist legislation from the onslaught of laissez-faire economics. But it's quite difficult to come up with an all-encompassing interpretation of Luddism, as it differs from region to region and industry to industry. In the Midlands, for example, disturbances were primarily industrial, using machine breaking to supplement other forms of negotiation. In Lancashire, Luddism was closest to being a political movement, as it harnessed the dissent of the whole population. This split interpretation, then, of the positive and negative effects of the wars is also clear when we look at its impact on society. The economic policies of the government resulted in a post-war boom for the rentier and aristocratic classes. Regency England is seen as the heyday of aristocratic swagger, the age of balls and masquerades, characterised in particular by the dandy Beau Brummel, the courtesan who blackmailed leading members of the government and aristocracy, Harriet Wilson, and of course Lord Byron, who was made instantly famous by his poem Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, which was published in 1812. However, this age of excess and aristocratic excess swept quickly through the country, and in 1816, both Beau Brummel and Byron exiled themselves to the continent, Beau Brummel to avoid creditors and Byron to avoid charges of buggery and incest. And there was a middle-class reaction to these excesses. In particular, a response came from the nonconformist sects and evangelical Anglicans. In 1816, for example, the largely Quaker movement, the Society for the Promotion of Permanent and Universal Peace, was established as the first international peace movement. You also have the rise of the Clapham sect, who are perhaps best known for their campaigns on the abolition of slavery. But they were also influential in publishing floods of tales, poems, and political tracts. They formed associations. They had their own official periodical, the Christian Observer. They were crusaders for the renewal of Christianity, the sanctity of the family, and female domesticity. You can also see examples of these sentiments in the literature of the period. So, for example, Mansfield Park, written by Jane Austen, which was published in 1811, contrasts the values of the heroine, Fanny Price, who clings to religion and morality, with those of the worldly, witty and sophisticated couple, Henry and Mary Crawford, who follow a hedonistic lifestyle. The economic and social effects of the war also had political consequences. The reduction in prices and wages and the numbers of discharged soldiers and sailors added to unemployment. there were a number of uprisings by the working class in the post-war period. In December 1816, a political meeting at Spa Field ended in an armed attack on the Tower and the suspension of habeas corpus. In 1817, blanket-carrying weavers from Manchester, known as the Blanketeers, assembled at St Peter's Field to march in the direction of London to present a petition to the Prince Regent. And later that year, there was a riot of textile workers in Derbyshire. Both of these two latter riots were encouraged by government spies and agents provocateurs. But the climax of the working class response to the social and economic distress of the wars happened in 1819, when the Manchester Patriotic Union Society invited Henry Orator Hunt and Richard Carlyle to speak at a public meeting in Manchester. The meeting took place on the 16th of August. There were around 50,000 people there by midday. Once the speakers arrived, the magistrates called in the yeomanry, and by 2 o'clock the soldiers had cleared most of the crowd from St Peter's Field, in the process killing 11 people and injuring 400, including 100 women. Richard Carlyle managed to avoid being arrested and took the first mail coach to London, publicising the events in Manchester. A full report of the meeting appeared in newspapers, including The Times, using his eyewitness account and those of other moderate radicals. It's also useful to look at the role of women in Peterloo. It was not unusual, but what was unique was the scale of their mobilisation. In the period leading up to Peterloo then, women had formed their own associations with female officers, held their own meetings and presented addresses. They were claiming the right to public space and inclusion within the political nation. However, this gave loyalist and government commentators the right to claim that the female reformers were an example of the lax manners and morals of the protesters. The result of Peterloo then was to further polarise the distance between the establishment, the aristocracy, and the broad consensus of the reforming public. When Parliament reassembled, a new battery of repressive measures, the Six Acts, were passed. And James Epstein has noted Peterloo as the moment where there is a change in working class politics from Paynite republicanism to popular constitutionalism.